Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. Sarah no longer had her women's flow. And Sarah laughed inwardly, saying, "After being shriveled, shall I have pleasure, and my husband is old?" You're listening to By the Well, a podcast for preachers where we discuss the lectionary readings to help you preach in your contexts. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And this week is the second Sunday after Pentecost. We're focusing on the readings Genesis chapter 18, verses 1 to 15, and chapter 21, 1 to 7, and Romans 5, 1 to 8, and Matthew 9, verse 35 to chapter 10, verse 8. And we're joined again by the Reverend Rachel Kronberger, who came to By the Well back in Advent. Rachel's the Uniting Church Minister at Yarraville Uniting Church. Welcome back, Rachel. It's great to have you with us again.
Thanks, Fran. Thanks,
Welcome.
Robin. It's good to be back here.
Rachel, I'm really keen to hear how you've experienced the last 2 months of quite extraordinary worship leading times. How's it been?
Thanks, Fran. It's been good. It's been interesting. My congregation has met on Zoom on Sunday mornings, and Zoom, as you would know, has limited time availability for people's concentration and energy. So worship services haven't gone for more than about 40 minutes, including welcoming people individually at the beginning and so on. And I've also been making YouTube videos each day with my Baptist colleague in Yarraville. And we just privately posted those for our congregations via email.
Mm.
So each week people have had a reflection on each of the lectionary readings, which has meant that on Zoom preaching has been able to be a bit more limited, a little bit more concise and focused.
Mm.
But it's been a good challenge as a preacher to condense a sermon into about 3 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Apart from the obvious time, has it changed your sort of awareness of what you do when you preach?
Oh, absolutely.
In what way?
Or partly you preach into a mirror so you can see yourself and see where your focus is and how that's going. That's really interesting. But it's also meant that, you know, the usual discipline I have in preparing sermons of sticking to a single point has really had to sharpen.
Yeah. Mm.
Mm. Well, and that's going to be a challenge in today's readings.
Yes, it will. You're going to have to make a few decisions, preachers out there.
Mm.
And we're in this period after Pentecost now where I think there are choices for preachers, particularly those of you who preach every week. We've got a series of readings now from Genesis that began last week with Genesis 1, but we're leaping into Genesis 18, which we'll discuss in a moment, and continuing that story. So if you want to really pick up the Genesis story, there might be some storytelling filling in the gaps of how we got here. And the same for Matthew. We're returning to Matthew in the year of Matthew, but we've been sort of hopping around and not really consistently with Matthew. And now we're going to go back and re-enter around chapter 10 of Matthew with the second teaching discourse of Jesus. We really left any thematic treatment of Matthew back with the Sermon on the Mount before Easter.
Mm.
So again, there might be some filling in some gaps and some decisions to make for preachers looking ahead in terms of which texts you focus on.
And even, you know, you might decide to do a series on Romans.
Mm.
Unfortunately, we won't be a huge amount of help on that initially because we're going to focus on Genesis.
We're going to talk about Genesis and Matthew mostly.
Mostly, yeah.
Although Romans obviously today is a text that reflects on the Genesis reading its own way.
A bit of a commentary on it.
Mm. But what do we notice straight away about this Genesis reading? We're in chapter 18. We've been journeying, if you read through Genesis, really for about 6 chapters now since the covenant promise to Abraham this man from Ur, which is kind of vaguely modern-day Iraq, ancient Babylon area, who's travelled as a boy with his family towards Canaan and then gets called by God to sort of continue that. What do you, either of you, notice about this text and what stands out to you as possibilities for preaching themes?
Well, the first thing for me was getting Rublev's icon image in my mind in reading the first line. So yeah. Rublev's icon was written, we write icons, we don't paint them, written in the 15th century.
Yep.
The background of the three figures, Father, Son and Holy Spirit, you see the Oaks of Mamre. And that's the image. And given we've just celebrated Trinity Sunday last week, I was struck by the collision of those images, which is quite deliberate, obviously, on the part of the artist.
Yeah, so there's an invitation to keep exploring images of God with the way
and the three figures here.
And I think the first verse is almost like a title that we as readers get. So the Lord appeared. We're told it's God that appears to Abram by the oaks of Mamre. But then it kind of goes into a narrative where Abraham raised his eyes and looked and he sees three men. He doesn't necessarily recognize the three men as God. So we have information that perhaps Abram himself didn't have.
Yes, when he says, my Lord, he's not saying Yahweh. There.
No, he's saying, sir. Yeah. Yep. Mm. Yep. Adonai is the word in Hebrew as opposed to the divine name.
Yes. Yeah.
That's really profound theologically though, isn't it? Like it's not doesn't start Abraham saw God, but the Lord appeared. So it's the Lord is the one
moving towards.
Moving towards.
Yes. And I think this text invites us to think about hospitality, obviously, but particularly hospitality of the divine, and which is what Rublev's icon does, right? Mm. It invites us to think about where we make space for the divine visit. Yep.
To acknowledge that we ourselves are welcome at the table and to extend that welcome as participants in God's mission.
Yep.
So hospitality is clearly, just in those first three verses, a really important theme in this story. And one thing you pointed out before we came on air was the reference to bread and that Abraham says, bring a little bread. And then when he speaks to Sarah, he says, get the best bread and get a lot of it.
That's right.
Yeah, the good flour.
Yeah.
And the killing of the calf and the curds, these are all abundant and expensive foods in
it's antiquity. Like the milk and honey kind of stuff, isn't it? And anyone who's been making sourdough during the lockdown will know that it's not something that can happen quickly.
Nope.
This is an all-day feast preparation that's made for the guests.
If you're killing the calf and then cooking it, this is a long meal. This isn't I just pulled some biscuits out of the pantry kind of.
No, and if you've ever been camping and you're trying to prepare a feast with camping equipment, you'll have some empathy for Sarah here and what she's trying to pull off so that Abraham can entertain his guests. Mm.
And it's not just the bread, it's the whole, it's the calf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As well.
Yes. The meat and which
that's
is precious.
Expensive, yeah. Yep.
And making the yogurt, it's all there.
Exactly. Mm. And I think there is metaphorically those details serve as a reminder in a couple of ways in the larger narrative that there is this juxtaposition or a parallel here with Abram's generosity towards these visitors will be mimicked or mirrored back by God's generosity to Abraham, not just to promise a son, but to actually promise a multitude of offspring.
And a future.
And a future, yeah. The other thing is in this broader context, if you really as a preacher wanted to explore the theme of hospitality, just to be aware in this text, chapter 18 and 19 go together and it's tricky and you may not want to go there, but this story really functions as a foil to the Sodom and Gomorrah story where we get an example of anti-hospitality, of hostility and harm to a stranger, and they belong together.
Mark Brett talks about that in his book Genesis, Procreation and the Politics of Identity. That's very good on that topic.
But Rachel, you'd notice some other things about the text because Sarah appears as an interesting character and what do we make of her laughter and all these other dynamics going on?
Oh, it's so interesting. Many of our members of our congregations are elderly and it's always interesting to me to think about what it's like to be a woman in her 80s or 90s listening to this reading and I imagine there's a lot more empathy with Sarah from the part of a member of a congregation listening to this reading than many preachers have often had.
Mm.
It is hilarious.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to be chuckling, perhaps.
Yes, that's right. And Sarah laughs because it is a ludicrous thing that someone of 90, I mean, most of the 90-year-olds I know hesitate to nurse a grandchild or great-grandchild because, you know, they worry about their energy levels.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really the thought of, it's not just the thought of giving birth, and those of you who've given birth would struggle to imagine doing so at 90, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the raising of a child and the what's required of a woman's body in the raising of a child, but Sarah's laughter is actually initially about what's going to be required in order to conceive the child.
Yes.
And you started, Robin, with Robert Alter's beautiful translation
that was
Robert, of that passage.
Which is slightly more vivid than the NRSV, although they both mention this word pleasure. And I have to say, growing up with this text, I think it was always sort of a little moralistically or euphemistically perhaps presented as her pleasure is the possibility of having a child, which of course if one yearns for a child is a pleasure. But it's this word in Hebrew, it's a play on words. It's a sexual term.
Yes, and the that Edna, is it, that has the same origin as Eden? Like it's a primal paradise like pleasure. It's quite visceral, and it's a little bit ambiguous about what's going to get in the way of Sarah having pleasure. Is it her own interest in what's required? Is it the breakdown in relationship between her and Abraham, as evidenced by what's gone on with Hagar in previous chapters and other threads that I think Fran's going to talk about in a minute? Or is it her lack of confidence in her husband to
perform the task?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot for Sarah to be skeptical about in this.
Yeah, and so her skepticism may be less about God's ability to do wondrous things and more about just the practicalities of her marital relationship.
Which really does liberate understanding of this passage from sort of Victorian moralistic readings or fairly judgmental ones about Sarah.
Yes. We want to paint her as the skeptic and Abraham as endlessly faithful. I think this humanises her, but they both at times have doubted and questioned. And
yeah, and certainly Abraham laughed in the last time the promise was offered to Abraham, he laughed.
Yeah.
So she's not the first one to laugh at this prospect.
No.
No, that's right. He does that in chapter 17, I think, which is why their son will end up being called Laughter. Isaac is a play on laughter.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to draw attention to one of those visitors' questions to Abraham, where is your wife Sarah? I suppose prior to that, I might say you could do a sermon from the point of view of Sarah or Abraham. Looking at this reading, is this an Abrahamic or a Sarahic tradition?
Yeah.
But also drawing this question of where is Sarah and connecting it to a question we read in the first creation story some weeks ago, Adam, where are you? And we also hear it with Cain and Abel, you know, Abel, where are you? Or the other way around. So that what God is doing is noticing a fracture in relationship and seeking to point it out so it might be reconciled, which draws in what you were saying, Rachel, about Hagar having, you know, got in the way of Sarah and Abraham's. Well,
the story presents as Sarah's idea, but you have to wonder a little bit at
the pressure she was
on.
That's right.
So that this is the story of a remarkable fulfillment of a promise and God doing impossible things, but it's also a story of reconciliation. This is a question. It's a story of reconciliation between Abraham and Sarah. And the fallout, you can see in the use of that language you were just talking about. Well, her laughter, is it that can we actually, what's going to be required and can we do it?
Yeah. And I think I think engaging with that, as you said, Robin, invites us into empathy with Sarah and protects us from that moralised kind of reading of it.
Yeah.
But I think also it's important for the preacher to point out that Sarah is a bit, well, she's presented a bit secondarily here in the narrative.
Yeah, which is typical.
Where is she? Yeah, she's she's in the tent.
Yeah, that's right.
Culturally appropriate, I suppose.
Culturally, most of the Bible are the men's stories from the men's point of view. And in fact, in this text and in fact in next week's text, I'm always intrigued when we do get these hints of women's responses and women's comments because they are so rare. It's a patriarchal narrative. It just reflects the reality of that time and place. So when we do get these insights into, you know, say Sarah laughing and Sarah speaking here about her own pleasure, this is a flag to pay attention that it's a quirky dynamic or a little bump in the text, if you think of it like that, something to pay attention to that is it's doing all sorts of work. It's humanizing her. It's reminding us symbolically of Isaac's name, which, you know, this maybe slightly skeptical laughter will turn into the laughter, the joyful laughter of having a son. We can't skip over those details too easily, I think.
And speaking of details, I think too it's important if you're going to preach on this to go through the history of this promise. Mm. So back to chapter 12, where Abraham was promised land and a great nation and that he would be blessed, and then they continued to be barren. And then in chapter 15, he's taken out to look at the many stars in the sky. And then it's chapter 16 where Hagar's sort of their human anthropological solution to this impossible problem. So I think those are details in terms of building up to this and the level of human disbelief. Well, we'd all be like that. We'd all disbelieve it. So it's around that, but also about God's time.
Yeah,
and fulfillment.
The waiting, I think, that the which Paul picks up, if we can turn to Romans very briefly.
Yes.
In Romans 5, we get this, you know, quite well-known passage perhaps where he talks about patience that produces character and character that produces hope, or and other translations might read patience that produces endurance and endurance that produces hope. So the sense that journeying with God and awaiting God's promises, you know, even when you have the best faith and the best hope, it requires endurance. There's rarely quick fixes and fast solutions.
Yeah, I read a reference to Tertullian, who wrote a piece on patience, I believe, that was then developed by another ancient thinker whose name escapes me. But it's sort of been lost, this virtue of patience in the Christian tradition. Has been lost, I think, in a lot of explicit ways that to our detriment in understanding how to be faithful.
Yes, and it's we were looking at the fruits of the Spirit at Pentecost, and patience is sometimes translated there as forbearance, and that's a really interesting nuance for me, that what we're able to find strength to endure.
Yeah, and I mean, as soon as we use this language, I must say a pastoral sort of red flag goes up in my brain, because there is something about forbearing and being patient, and I think we are, if anything, we lean in the other direction these days, where we live in such a fast-paced world where we expect everything to happen immediately that we tend to be impatient. But I'm also conscious that sometimes these kinds of texts, particularly the Pauline one about suffering patiently, can be used as an excuse to not challenge evil and to not challenge abuse.
And we're seeing that happening in the US at the moment, where people who have been told to be forbearant and to be patient and to endure their suffering
peacefully
have reached the end of their tether. And we're recording this 10 days out from the Sunday you'll be preaching, but keep an eye on the news, because that's what people are going to be watching.
Yeah, that's
right. Between now and when you're preaching on this.
That's right. Yep. Is there anything else we want to say about Romans, or should we move on to Matthew?
Can I just double back briefly on both Romans and Genesis? I think it's really important for preachers in this time of live streaming sermons and posting sermons on YouTube that you a lot of people are reporting a much wider audience than their usual congregation, and so you have no idea who's listening to your sermon at the moment. And these are pastorally sensitive issues. They're issues which, just in the essential story of Abraham and Sarah, you're going to have people listening who had hoped to have children and weren't able to. And they might have had, as Sarah's experience probably of these visitors, people winking at them and saying, oh, you'll have a baby with us for next Christmas, and, you know, those kinds of difficult things. So you don't know who's listening, and just entering into this story empathically is really going to be important for your care of people. And likewise with the Romans, being really cautious about how you speak about other people's suffering that that you really don't have any idea about.
Yeah. Thank you, Rachel. And the readings don't necessarily get easier when we turn to Matthew.
No.
Look, we've probably said this almost every second podcast this year, but in the year I electionary, I sometimes do not understand the decisions that were made because, again, we have a very strange set of verses for the gospel text that take us from the end of chapter 9 with this language about a harvest. And maybe the impetus to start in 9:35 is because we do get this rather tender moment of Jesus' compassion for the crowds.
Yes.
And it uses this Greek word that sounds a bit like splanctha. It's like a movement in your gut when you have a gut-wrenching reaction of compassion to the crowds. So it starts with that tenderness. But actually we're going to move into a bunch of sayings that are quite hard and a call that is quite difficult in chapter 10, which is the second major discourse, teaching discourse of Jesus, this time directed quite specifically to the disciples. So what did you two notice about Matthew or what theme? I mean, there's probably a bazillion themes here and it's a matter of picking one or two to.
I really like Brendan Byrne's take on this. Brendan's commentary on the Gospel of Matthew is called Lifting the Burden. And he says that when Jesus is moved with compassion, like he is here and sees the people as sheep without a shepherd, it's the way in which humanity appears to Jesus, harassed and dejected and burdened. And so Jesus' ministry is about addressing and remedying the situation and lifting the burden of the people. And that's what Jesus needs the laborers for. I think we've sometimes framed those laborers in a much narrower way as people carrying a message about faith rather than a gift of release and liberation.
Yep.
And I think it's important for us in preaching this to be able to name some of the ways in which people are feeling harassed and dejected and burdened. And certainly, as I was saying before about what's happening in the US and around the world, it's turning out that people are able to see in Australia where some of those same issues are.
I was going to say, we can't overlook that they don't get the media attention here, but we're starting to be attentive to the same dynamics.
That's right. It reminded me of in the novel Home, Marilyn Robinson has one of her preachers parsing the broken heart of humankind and praising the perfect love of Jesus Christ. And I think for me, that's my core task as a preacher, to parse the broken heart of humankind and praise the perfect love of Jesus Christ. And I think that has to be at the heart of preaching from this text from Matthew once again, to avoid moralizing and finger pointing and judging.
Yep. There's also, I mean, this is a high calling. Well, there's one fun fact I want to point out, that Matthew only uses the word apostle here in the whole gospel once, and it's here in 10:2. An apostle in other places in the New Testament is a pretty high calling, but it's the one place where he uses it for the disciples, this 12. And he sends them out. And again, if you've been following the lectionary, last week we heard the so-called Great Commission, so Matthew sending out to all nations. This week we've stepped back about 25 steps because they're sent to, I was really struck with the order of the lectionary to go back to this text.
The lost house.
They're sent to the lost house of the sheep, you know, house of Israel, or the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It's very local and specific mission. They're explicitly told, don't go into Samaritan territory, don't go to the Gentiles, stick to your kind of home turf. It's very local mission. And while I feel conflicted about that, I think it may well reflect a historic reality at this point in Jesus' ministry. It might also give us permission, or at least provoke us in our congregations, to have a conversation about, you know, at least if mission isn't starting at home locally, then what are we doing? We've too often looked overseas or looked far beyond at something at distance.
Yeah, I think there's also a theological point to be made there that I think I read Rowan Williams make, that, you know, this first call to mission, go to where there is a history of God. So it's if you read that verse, take it seriously, it does very much challenge that colonial way of going where, well, you can't have heard this before. You know, you must have no knowledge of this. So I find that quite an interesting take on just those few words in the context of talking about mission.
Yeah, that's helpful.
There's also coming back to Abraham. Abraham's called, is blessed by God to be a blessing, and he's called to build up a nation that will be a light to the nations. And maybe there's something here about Jesus looking to bring healing to the lost sheep of Israel and draw those blessed people together again and deeply embed that history.
It's an interesting contrast with the star. I know the starry sky part of the promise to Abraham isn't in this part of the lectionary, but that's quite a contrast too with, you know, the extent of the promised blessing.
Yes, being
and this sort of approach to mission here,
which will open up again. So we've got to hold that tension. I think the other thing to say here with you know, Jesus begins to teach them. It goes on for a whole chapter, and we're just getting a little bit. But effectively, what he tells them to do is do what I've been doing. Mm. So when you're sent as an apostle or a disciple of Jesus, you are sent to be Jesus in those places, literally to be. There's a lot of commissioning language here that in the ancient world, if you were commissioned as someone's agent, authorized by them, the authority language here, you are sent to be their representative in the full sense of that word. You embody them, you speak for them, you have their authority to act or make decisions. And, I mean, that's a huge calling. And if we think of this as a calling for all disciples, I mean, here it's geared to the 12, it does also remind us in the church that we're not called to go to church for our own sake.
No.
We are always called to be sent.
Mm. Yeah, and that was John's point on your Pentecost podcast as well, that that this is the calling of the church. It's not for ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's also not something we invent, you know. No. In that embodiment of what we do as Jesus did, it's not something we're not being required to invent some new thing, which is I would find a massive burden.
Mm. Yep.
Not that doing what Jesus did is remotely easy.
No.
But you know what I mean.
And, I mean, we might not do these exact things, which do include raising the dead and exercising demons, but I found the commentary of Greg Carey on the Working Preacher site helpful, where he clustered all of these activities under sort of two themes of healing and liberation. Mm. If our ministry isn't bringing healing and it's not liberating for people, then that's the sort of time to stop and reflect. How is our ministry, how is our mission healing and liberating?
And that's the ministry of our whole congregation. That's not that's not our ministry as preachers. That is our that's we are leading a congregation into that ministry.
Yes.
And if just one final observation in terms of that is also the apparent, the fickleness of these characters. So we've got a tax collector and we've got one who betrays and we've got in the Genesis reading, we've got Abraham and Sarah who just didn't believe, and fair enough, but, you know, they organised their own way through the promise through Hagar and so on. There's something about, that ministry that we're all called to, but a liberating comfort that we don't have to be perfect.
No, not at all.
And actually God rarely chooses the so-called perfect.
And the only thing that was special about Abraham was that God called him and God spoke to him. Yeah. That was it.
We know nothing of his qualities before that to make him deserving of that attention.
And what he did in response was to listen.
Yeah. Mm. Well, thank you so much, Rachel Kronberger, for being with us today. And you can hear more of Rachel on next week's podcast too. You've been listening to By the Well,
a podcast made with support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Thanks for listening.